topic. So, talking about vestments, and I want to, as you can probably see, there's a little bit of space here for show and tell that Deacon Joshua is going to assist us in, right? So Deacon Joshua is going to be wearing those vestments here in just a few months. So I think he's a little eager to share. So I do just want to say, this is an evening for sharing. Please do not take pictures or things like that, okay? This is, you know, something that's meant to be fun, but, you know, there don't need to be photos of Deacon Joshua, you know, trying on vestments or whatever downstairs. I don't need Deacon Joshua's vocation director calling me going, what are you doing at IC, right? Like, so make my life easy, make his easy, just enjoy the moment, don't take pictures. No, but before we get into the specifics of the vestments, I want to talk just about, okay, so why do we even have vestments? You know, what's the purpose of them? I think especially us as Americans that have been pretty heavily influenced, not just by Protestantism, but ultimately by a kind of puritanical Protestantism, and that then kind of flows into, through a variety of intellectual influences, into evangelical Protestantism. What in the world is the purpose of vestments, right? Why do they matter? And of course, that isn't just like an evangelical Protestant kind of thing. There are plenty of Catholics who go, that's just a waste of money. That's a bunch of just self-aggrandizement. Why does the church care so much? And so this is how you end up with vestments that look like, you know, and feel like, frankly, when you're wearing them, burlap sacks or, you know, whatever, that are really kind of seemingly undignified, even in the name of a kind of false simplicity. So there are intellectual underpinnings to all of that that deserve being addressed, because to be fair to those who may take some sort of an exception, they are maybe attempting, wrongly, but attempting to lean into, with some sort of goodwill, the idea that, hey, Jesus was simple. You've probably heard me before kind of talk about, you kind of see this in pop culture. If you've ever seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, right? So at the end, Indiana Jones is standing there. He's got all these different chalices, right, in front of him. And only one of them is the chalice that Jesus used at the Last Supper. And that's the one in the movie that's going to have, like, the fountain of eternal life in it. And Indiana Jones guesses rightly, chooses wisely, that it's this very simple, unornate kind of wooden kind of chalice. Oh, it's a carpenter's chalice. Well, whoever wrote the movie had terrible theology, but they were a good student of the sense of culture, right? This is what we think of, okay, so Jesus absolutely was one who lived with those who were poor, but the Jewish tradition has a very, very clear understanding of the importance of liturgical beauty. All we need to do is look at the intense instructions that are given for the construction of the tent of meeting as the Israelites are traveling through the desert, even in the midst of their exile. So who's doing Exodus 90 out of the guys? Anybody here? Okay, so there may be a couple of guys, but if you've ever done Exodus 90, one of the things that, at least when I've done it, they talk about is the importance that's put on the construction of the temple. So if you go back into the Old Testament, you will see the painstaking detail that God goes into with Moses and Aaron, yes, but then also with those whom he chooses, who are skilled at the construction of physical materials, so the making of tent poles and the making of the metal that goes into the Ark of the Covenant, working with jewels, craft, that kind of thing. And then those who also are able to do, make the cloth of the tent, who are able to make the cloth of the vestments. It is a deeply detailed kind of reality, and there is no expense that is spared when it comes to the worship of God. And so this is already something that is within the Jewish tradition that Jesus himself does not repudiate. And in fact, even as you look at the early tradition, because St. John Chrysostom has a very beautiful homily talking about the care of the poor that's sometimes invoked wrongly, like against liturgical beauty, because he says that if you will not find Christ in the poor, begging in front of the church, you will not find him in the chalice. which is a profoundly beautiful thing, but it's not an either or, which is often how those who kind of want to weaponize that will use it. Instead, it's a both and. The church would say, yes, we are to give sacrificially both in recognizing Christ in our neighbor and in honoring him in creating beautiful things. So you know from having listened to me that I could go on about beauty, especially beauty in the liturgy, a whole lot. So I want to really make sure that we talk about the specifics of vestments and vesture. So that's just, if there's more you're interested in there, I'm happy to talk more about it, send you information about it. Just know that this is at least grounded within the scriptures, not just then in the Old Testament, but the last note on that is to then look into the book of Revelation and the liturgical worship that is presented within the book of Revelation as heavenly worship. And so there are through lines that run both from the Old Testament into the New as well. So all of that to say that these things do matter. We don't have the option from within our tradition or from the theological tradition that Jesus himself chose to become incarnate in and was nurtured by, and oh, by the way, that the Lord himself established. This is part of who we are. So that then brings us to what does it look like to start vesting? And I will approach it from the reality of vesting as a priest. So yes, there are a couple of things maybe that would be more specific to deacons, but we're gonna stay focused just on the priestly vestments because they are maybe the best illustration of like the ultimate, the overall meaning of vesture. So I brought kind of as a little bit of a guide the prayers that the priest is supposed to pray. So, for example, in the extraordinary form of the Mass, it's not optional that I would pray these things. So the time that I'm spending before Mass is still, in a remote way, part of the liturgy. I'm required to pray those prayers. So when you see me on Sunday morning bouncing from one sacristy to the other, actually what starts the prayer process is the washing of the priest's hands. So we don't have a faucet on the other side, so I have to go over to the other, and then I go back over and do the rest of the vestments. But so it starts with this, just the symbolic, the washing of the hands. That's an obvious enough symbol that it is, right? Washing things away, you know, cleansing, as the prayer says, cleanse my hands, O Lord, from all stain, that pure in mind and body I may be worthy to serve thee. So then you would go, and the first thing that you put on, and Deacon, if you want to display what this is. And I'm going to focus, as I'm talking about these different elements of liturgical vesture, I'm going to talk a little bit about history, but I'm really going to focus on what we might call the mystagogical. So what is the actual overall purpose of the vestment? Because you could spend a lot of time talking about all of the different aspects of this, but let's just focus on, like, how does this best lead us closer to the Lord in prayer? So the amice is, kind of, let's say there are three roles to this. So the amice is a, you're great at that. There are three parts to it. So let's just start with the practical, right? So the practical is that keeps your alb from getting disgusting. Because what you do, if you want to try and put it on, Deacon, it is, yep, that's, it tucks into your collar, because it gets a little hot and sweaty in there. And so it literally absorbs the sweat and the dirt from your neck and everything so that it doesn't mess up your alb. It's a lot easier to clean an amice than it is to clean an alb. And so then, as you saw, Deacon kind of touched his head. So I'll read the prayer in English that you're praying as you're putting on the amice. Place, O Lord, the helmet of salvation upon my head to repel the assaults of the devil. So it is representative, you know, kind of using St. Paul's language from Ephesians, it's representative of the helmet of salvation. And so the priest then is asking that essentially that your mind would be focused on what you are doing, that you will not be assaulted by the evil one in the celebration of the liturgy, but rather would be able to be focused on what ultimately you are meant to be doing in that time. A couple of funny stories. You get the weirdest looks at when you're putting on the amice, because most people probably don't know. I'm not going to ask by show of hands who even knew that an Amos existed in here, but it's higher than average, I can guarantee you that, in this room, because most people, it kind of fell out of usage for a while, because we got a little clever. We created albs that sort of included like straps that went up a little higher, and this is where it gets into not so much liturgical theology, but style. So we went through a stylistic period where you have, and my albs are kind of that way, that they actually zip up to the neck. So in theory, you wouldn't need an amice. So the liturgical law of the church is that your vestments should really cover up your street clothes. So the idea is that anything that is Aaron is covered over, because liturgy isn't about Aaron. Liturgy is about Jesus. And so ultimately, the vestments are meant to obscure what's me, to point to Jesus. And the amice is the foundation of that. But if you happen to have an alb that suffices for that, that's sufficient. But you definitely get a lot of weird looks when you go into some sacristies and you start putting the amice on. You're like, what is that thing? Like, especially like when you go, like when you're celebrating Mass for high schoolers, that's when I get the most looks of, they're like, what are you doing? I've never seen that before. So there's the amice. So then the next is the alb that you put on. So we recognize the alb, right? The alb is something that is actually a universal Christian garment. All of us were given our alb at our baptism, right? This is the white garment that is given to us, often symbolically, like here at IC in St. Lent's, right? We have this this little like cloth triangle, but it's representative of this. And what do we hear in the book of Revelation? Well, these who are dressed in white, they are the ones who have washed their garments clean in the blood of the Lamb, right? So this is representative of having been cleansed in soul by baptism in the blood of Jesus. So all of us have an alb. This is why servers can wear albs, right? It is the foundational sort of vesture of a Christian person. So it's the reminder to the priest that before anything else, you are, in fact, a Christian, as St. Augustine would say, right? With you, I am your pastor. For you, I am your pastor. With you, I am a Christian. And so this is that reminder of that. Now, again, there are diversities of style of albs. So I pretty strongly like albs that just sort of zip up along the neck. That's, I've gotten comfortable. I'm a creature of habit. After 10 years, that's pretty much what I've got. But you will see guys who have called square neck albs. So you have your amice, and then it's just basically like a, it's sort of like the surpluses that our servers wear, for example, but it's longer. That just kind of drives me a little crazy, but there's nothing, that is a legitimate alb. That's just a place of personal preference. The other thing that kind of comes down to style is the amount of lace that's on it, right? So the lace work, obviously this is a very beautiful alb that Deacon has, that is, I would say, more of a maximal kind of vision of having the lace. So think of the lace work very much like what we look at when we talk about the decorations of a church that have vines and other symbols like that. It is, again, symbols of a new creation. So as I've explained this to kids before, when a priest has different symbols or things like that on his vestments, it's not, oh, flowers are nice, Jesus is nice, and so it's just all nice. No, it's actually like a mockery of the evil one, that the very way in which creation is recreated and saved is through the liturgy. And so it is this reminder. Anytime we see, especially like flowers, this is a reminder of the recapitulation of the Garden of Eden. Creation is itself being restored by the saving work of Christ. So vestment makers will do different things. And again, they're artists. And so sometimes artists like to really ply their craft. And so this is another way in which the church has supported arts and drawn the reality of beauty into the work of the liturgy. So the prayer that goes with the alb, cleanse me, O Lord, and purify my heart, that being made white in the blood of the Lamb, I may attain everlasting joy. So a lot of these prayers that the priest is praying are, of course, to prepare him for the liturgy, but also to seek out his own sanctification and salvation. So it also reminds you that as a priest, you should be celebrating this well, not just for the sake of like the people being well cared for, but also for the fidelity, the care of your own soul. All right, so next we move on to the cincture. So this is the rope, right, that goes around the priest's waist. Practically, it does keep you from tripping over your alb. There is a very much a practical value in that. So the prayer, I think, is best to start with. Gird me, O Lord, with the girdle of purity, and quench in me the fire of concupiscence, that the grace of temperance and chastity may abide in me. So this is a reminder to the priest of his promise of chastity manifested particularly through the living of celibacy. It is the reminder, right? So it captures that concupiscence is real. So concupiscence, right, is the part of us that is wounded by the fall and is bent the wrong direction as a result. So it is the disordering of our various appetites, whether that's for food, drink, sexuality, and of course, specifically the cincture, just given where it's located, is, you know, the belly, the appetite kind of area of the body. So it is even the reminder of the priest, you are embodied, you are subject to concupiscence. And so even as you prepare to celebrate the liturgy, you're asking the Lord to help discipline and reorder and guide those things. And again, you know, this is a very like high kind of cincture that the deacon has in terms of it's got gold worked through it. I mean, not actual gold, I don't think so, at least, if that's the case. Yeah. I want to know where you got it from, if that's the case. No. Yeah, that would make sense. No, the gold work, again, the filigree at the ends of it, this is a very much an artistic display on the part of the artist who makes these things. Again, because it is, I'm making something noble for the worship of the Lord. All right, so this is something that is ultimately preserved then in Mass in the extraordinary form, has not been kept in the ordinary form of the Mass. It's called the maniple. So much like the amice, this begins with a very practical purpose. Air conditioning is a new invention. And perennially, you also sometimes get a runny nose. You sometimes get, you know, you had a piece of your vestments that would help as a sweat rag, or that even you could wipe your nose with. And over time, it became an artistic part of the liturgy that then also had a spiritual meaning attached to it. So it goes onto your left arm, kind of right onto the forearm. And obviously, you've never seen me wipe my nose with any of the maniples that we have here or wipe sweat with that. It is a symbolic vestment that has, especially since it's on the left side, it is meant to represent the earthly life and ministry and suffering of Jesus. So I'm left-handed. And so mom and dad didn't have the life of, you know, breaking me of being left-handed. But we know that in Latin, left, the word is very similar to the word for sinister. And so for a long time, there was the effort to break children who were left-handed of being left-handed and make them right-handed because it became a little superstitious. What's interesting is the liturgy does preserve not so much left bad, right good, but rather the left is that which is earthly. So the priest wears the maniple as a reminder of the burdens, the sorrows, and the griefs of Christ, as well as his own. And there is definitely an element, like vestments are not easy to move in. For me, on Sunday mornings, the maniple is actually like a place of perpetual annoyance because it's just always in the way. It's always getting caught on the body of the chasuble, or it's getting caught on the edge of the altar. And some of that is by design, right? It's not meant to be just easy or convenient. It is representative of the griefs, the burdens, the sorrows of Christ. And so the other way that this is often presented liturgically. And since I've been back, I guess when I left to go to St. John the 23rd, Father Conway, frankly, out of annoyance more than anything else, when I talked to him, started asking the altar servers to tie the maniple. Typically, they have ties on the inside of them so that they stay on your arm and don't move around. I never bothered with it. It bothered him. And so he started asking the servers to do it, which actually I probably should have been doing, because theologically, it's also representative of our Lord himself as he was going into his passion, being tied up, being stripped and dressed according to somebody else's whims. So it is a place of spiritual discipline for the priest to go, okay, I'll stand here and let somebody else, even as Jesus says to Peter, right, someone else will dress you. And so, okay, I have to humble myself and allow that to happen. It's very interesting. So, of course, the extraordinary form has sort of preserved the sort of ceremonial dimensions of how the liturgy works. So cardinals, when they process in for high liturgies, will have, they're called capa magna, so big capes is literally what that means. They have a big cape. It's a big red cape that they wear, and it is, if it's like a real capa magna, it's cartoonishly long. Like it is, you're like, this is ridiculous. And it almost looks like opulence. And I've even heard people who really don't know better say, oh, what an opulent kind of display. That's kind of the point, actually. Because what it's meant to be is that the cardinal walks in on the same level as the people, right, through the body of the church, through the world, with all of this honor. And as soon as he gets to the foot of the sanctuary, the servers essentially strip him of it. And he goes into the sanctuary and begins vesting, not with vestments that speak of honor, but vestments that speak of the burdens, the griefs, and the sorrows of Jesus. So he is reminded, however high you may go within the life and power of the world and the church, it will be stripped away from you in the celebration of the liturgy, which everything is about. Properly received, it's actually meant to deflate the egos of those with power. So the maniple, the prayer for it, grant me, O Lord, to bear the light burden of grief and sorrow, that I may with gladness receive the reward of my labor. So in this, then, again, not only is the spiritual reality of being reminded of the sufferings of Jesus, but then it also is the reminder of the priest that what you are bringing to the Mass yourself is the labor, the burdens, the griefs, the sorrows of the people. And so there are definitely times for me when I'm getting the maniple stuck on my chasubles, I'm trying to move my hands around, where it's like, okay, Lord, like, yeah, what in the week has caught me that way, right? Like, what has caused me to have to slow down, to pivot, to do things differently? What in the life of my people is burdening me? What has been laborious and toilsome? Because the Mass is the place that goes, because I don't save the people of God. That's Jesus. And so this is the place of like bringing that to him to be redeemed. So the priest is reminded of this as he carries that out.
Is there a time when you take this off during the
liturgy? So in the extraordinary form of the Mass, there are two different emphases between the extraordinary form of the Mass and the ordinary form of the Mass when it comes particularly to preaching. That's the place where most commonly the priest is instructed by the instruction of the liturgy to take the maniple off. It rests on the missal. So it rests on the book for the celebration of the liturgy. This is what you wear for Mass. But then in the understanding like of the extraordinary form, preaching, right, preaching on the readings is not a required and essential element of the Mass itself. You can observe this in other ways that, for example, in the ordinary form of the Mass, if you have a confirmation or a wedding, it takes place right after the proclamation of the gospel generally, right after the gospel and then the homily, and then you have whatever the liturgical celebration is kind of in the heart of the Mass. In the extraordinary form of the Mass, it takes place right at the beginning, right? So it's outside of the beginning of the Mass, because as much as possible, the logic of the extraordinary form of the Mass was, we don't interrupt the celebration of the Lord. It's this whole cloth kind of thing. Preaching, though, was always the sort of exception, but the way that it is indicated as something of an exception is that the celebrant takes his maniple off for the proclamation of the word. Now, I also think there was a practical reason to that, because it's really easy, especially because there have been times where I've forgotten to take it off. And it's a lot easier to get it caught on like a pulpit or an ambo as you're moving around. So I think there were practical, but there are also very deeply theological reasons that you take it off for something that is not an essential element of the Mass itself. So good question. So next is the stole. So the stole is, and actually, so Deacon just kissed the middle of the stole, which is something that we do. Actually, as you are putting on your vestments, typically your amice, your maniple, and your stole are all things that you kiss as a priest. And these are because of, you know, what they represent. The stole is representative of priestly authority. And actually, this goes back to Roman vesture. So anybody who tells you most of the vestments, I know without a doubt where this thing came from, they probably are a little too confident in their sources. Generally, there are like a handful of possibilities that then in the life of the church became sort of uniform. So out of the different options in terms of where the stole came from, the one that I am most inclined to lean into is the fact that those who had Roman authority, like in the government, had some sort of like a scarf or what we would call a stole, that was worn indicative of their authority. And part of this is that the stole is the thing that is always, whenever you are exercising priestly authority, you are making sure you're wearing. You hear confessions in a stole. When you baptize someone, you are absolutely at least in a stole. When you are anointing somebody, you put a stole on. When you are receiving a couple's vows, you are wearing a stole. Other things can change depending on the context of the liturgy, but the stole is always worn, and it is indicative of, again, that authority. And over time, we end up stylizing it and making it, again, a way of displaying, beauty and good craftsmanship for the glory of the Lord himself. But it is ultimately representative of the priest's authority. Now, there are different ways in which we're instructed to wear them. So in the extraordinary form of the Mass, you cross the stole over yourself. That was what priests did, and then it was the bishops to wear, prior to 1962, the stole just hanging down. So there were just degrees of authority that were indicated as a kind of quick visual reference. That's sort of been, it's not been preserved after 1962. There's nothing that would stop you from wearing it that way as a priest, but it's just not something that carries the kind of visual significance that it would have used to. So it was just, again, going back to kind of the different ways of identifying who had authority within Roman governance, the way in which you may have worn this precursor to the stole was indicative of what your role or level of authority was. So the prayer that goes with this, give me again, O Lord, the stole of immortality, which I lost by the transgression of my first parents. And although I am unworthy to come unto the holy mystery, grant that I may attain everlasting felicity. So there are a lot of things that are going on there, particularly the invocation of our first parents. So as you go into the tradition, and how the church fathers, even how Jewish scholars spoke of what took place in Genesis, the understanding is that the first priest is Adam. There is this understanding that Adam is exercising a kind of primordial priesthood, and that that is forfeited. In fact, there's a really wonderful book that I'm reading right now, and I won't get sidetracked, I promise, but Bishop Eric Varden. He's a very wonderful, he's a European bishop. He's also a monk. He's written a book just recently on chastity, and he's referring to it as the reconciliation of the senses. So there's a wholeness to it. But he spends a great deal of time at the beginning talking about the understanding of ultimately the gift of being embodied, and he walks through the church fathers as well as the early Jewish writers of the understanding of the way in which our first parents were clothed. He spends a great deal of time talking about the clothing of Adam and Eve being clothed in glory, actually in what St. John Paul II will call original nakedness. That it is being clothed with the glory that is ultimately the glory of the Lord, that is lost. Adam and Eve attempt to clothe themselves with the fig leaves, and then God in his greatness reclothes them, ultimately with leather clothing as they are sent out of the garden. But then ultimately in Christ, they are returned to this state of being clothed in glory through him and us as well with them. But in this kind of running through, there is you see these little glimpses of Adam being referred to as a priest. So the loss of the clothing is also indicative of the loss of his priesthood, the role of his priesthood, the loss of that priestly power. And so, again, the fact that this prayer sort of preserves that sensibility of that we are being reminded of our first parents is an interesting theological through line that's just kind of snapshotted in this prayer. And again, reminding the priest that, hey, the exercise of this authority that's been given to you is important as you come to the celebration of this mystery. And if your first parents lost it, you also could lose it. And so you are asking the Lord to help you in maintaining that, being faithful in the exercise of your priestly ministry in the way perhaps that Adam was not. And finally, the last thing that you put on is the chasuble. So this is the one and only time Deacon's going to get to wear his chasuble before he's ordained a priest. Now, Deacon, are these your first Mass vestments?
No.
These are not. Okay. All right. We'll have to wait
except
to see
for
you
what
in
I'm
those.
Practicing celebrating.
By the way, if you ever come in and into St. Wenceslaus to pray and you happen to see Deacon standing at the altar, he is not secretly celebrating the Mass. He has to practice the Mass, and it's best to do that in the church, at the altar, in vestments, so you actually know what it's like, but he's not celebrating Mass secretly, I promise. Okay, so here we have the chasuble. Prayer for the chasuble. O Lord, who has said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light, grant that I may so bear it as to attain my grace. Traditionally, also, this is representative of, so the word chasuble, it's really fun, comes from a Latin word that just means tiny house. Because it was it's probably finds its origin in like a traveling cloak that would have been over the top of garments. And one of the ways that we can tell that that's the case, and if you were at the Candlemas Mass, I made a slight reference to this, that you notice when I celebrate the extraordinary form of the Mass, and you can do it in the ordinary form, I just don't prefer it, I get too distracted. But you have the servers at the side holding the sides of the priest's vestments up. That's kind of silly when it's like this, because you're not going to catch your arms on anything. But when you go back to the various styles of chasubles that existed, and especially back to their origin, they went past your arms, so you needed them moved out of your way. So you have various ways of doing that. Most often it was done through other ministers helping you, but also you'll sometimes see styles where there are like cords that you would be able to kind of tie the thing up so that they don't get in the way. So this is indicative of the fact that it is the chasuble, this traveling cloak that would have been used. And the practice would have been early in the life of the church that the way that they indicated, hey, this is not just a normal traveling cloak, is that they would save the best or the nicest or the newest one for the use when the community gathered for the celebration of the liturgy. So again, this recognition that what's happening in the liturgy is different and that God deserves that which is of the highest value, the greatest dignity. And then as time goes on, artists go, hey, you know what? Let's actually make this even more beautiful. So we see, for example, like if you want to see the earliest Christian art, just start Googling Christian art in the catacombs, right? This is where, when we're being persecuted, the Christians go and are celebrating mass literally over the sepulchers of martyrs. And they are facing what we would call ad orientem, so they're facing the same direction as the people, because that's the way that makes sense. You don't have a table set up in the middle of the catacombs. You are facing up against the wall. Everybody's praying together. And so up over those parts of the catacombs, you'll see various Christian images, iconography. But then also you can very easily see where you'd be taking these cloaks and you'd be decorating them, again, kind of indicating, elevating in a very human, very incarnate way, the dignity of what's taking place there. The other thing that for me, I think about a lot, if you've ever been to an Eastern Catholic liturgy, so something that's like, you know, Greek Orthodox, or excuse me, Greek Catholic, or Melkite, or Ukrainian Rite Catholic, Byzantine, I mean, you take your pick of the 23 or 24, some other Eastern rites, a lot of them preserve what's called an iconostasis, right? So an icon wall between where the people gather and where the priest and the other ministers of the liturgy are during the celebration, what we would call this, like the Eucharistic prayer. It's to preserve the mystery and to remind us that we are entering into the heavenly dimension. That's the way that the Eastern Church has preserved it. I would argue that vestments serve as a kind of quasi-living iconostasis in the West, that is ultimately the purpose of what they're supposed to do. And, you know, out of the mouths of babes, just the other week, I was, after Mass, had a little kid, 5 or 6, come to me and ask me, pointing, tugging on the vestment, pointing to the back of it, why you have that back there? This is the whatever image was on the back. I can't remember which vestment I was wearing. And it was, again, this reminder of, like, this is what they spent most of Mass looking at. And so they were pondering this image, right? This was kind of leading them into something. So we have that posture. That's really what the vestments are meant to do. So this goes kind of full circle back to the amice, right? The amice is covering over my street clothes. So the chasuble, every piece of the vestments, it's ultimately meant to reveal Christ, partially by the concealing of the priest, but ultimately by their dignity, they are meant to lead us into Christ, who is the celebrant. It's meant to highlight, draw our attention to the one who is present with us, not only as the lamb that is sacrificed, but also as the priest who is offering the sacrifice too. Now, a couple of other elements of liturgical vesture that don't necessarily fit the celebration of the Mass, but are still valuable. So Deacon, you brought yours with you, the beretta. Right? So it's the four-pointed, three-finned hat. Ours are different sized. Deacon has a slightly bigger head than me. So it's not hard to choose the right one on Sunday morning.
It was a competition when I got
married. It was. We wanted to see who's going to have the bigger head. So we'll go with the fact that Deacon probably is smarter than Father Aaron, but he has the bigger head. Very simply, why does the priest have a hat? So that he can take it off. That's literally the reason. It has been a long tradition within Western culture. A man humbles himself when he's in the presence of authority or those worthy of honor by taking his hat off. Just like, ladies, you veil in the presence of our Lord and his dignity. The church, in the celebration of the liturgy, sort of codified, all right, one more way, Father, here, that you show your humility, that before God you ritually take your hat off. And so those are the moments, and particularly, like, when you think of the extraordinary form of the Mass, it's the times at other points in the liturgy where you would be genuflecting, for example. So it is one way that the church has given for the priest to once again humble himself. Nope, you're taking off that thing that represents your office or your dignity or whatever. No, you are humbling yourself before Christ. You are before him, one of his disciples. A couple of the other pieces of symbolism there. So there are the three fins. You really only ever pick it up liturgically by the middle fin. And so three fins, of course, the three persons of the Holy Trinity. How do we come to know God? Well, ultimately through our connection with the second person of the Trinity. So even there, the practice of like the Beretta became very structured. Even it is trying to teach us, right? The church doesn't waste anything in all of these visual symbols. Two more pieces of vestments. So there are times where, for example, adoration, wedding outside of Mass, baptism outside of Mass. Most liturgical functions outside of Mass, you would wear a cope, and it looks like a cape, right? So same root word, a kappa, but the other Latin word for a cope is a pluviale, and the word pluvia is just rain. So it's a rain cloak, is what it was. I would never take any of our copes out into the rain, but that was an initial kind of function that was there. And even as you look on the back of ours, where there's the triangle that kind of runs along the back, that's a reminder of the fact that there used to be a hood functionally that would have been there. So again, very practical, but that ultimately was then turned into just one way of dignifying liturgical celebrations that did not require a chasuble. So liturgical celebrations outside of Mass. I mentioned before one of my seminary professors who said, very simply, the way that we show honor to something is by putting stuff on stuff, right? So, you know, this is why men, we put on ties. One of the great reasons to get ordained, you never have to wear a tie again. Right, you know, ladies, you put jewelry on. None of these things are, strictly speaking, functional, right? They don't have a purpose. In terms of, you know, your belt keeps your pants up, well, your tie doesn't keep your shirt on, you know, these things don't have necessity behind them. They are ways of showing dignity or honor of the situation we're stepping into, the people that we're going to be with, and so this has been preserved in the life of the church. We put stuff on stuff. That's what we do to show honor. So how do we show that this is an honored kind of event? Even if it's not Mass, we put on a cope. That's what we do. That's a little, it's not terrible, it's not crass, but one of the guys was a few years ahead of me in seminary. I'll never forget, and I think of this occasionally when I'm putting a cope on, because it's not always required, but he would say, you don't go out in your underwear. If you had the chance to put your cope on or leave it off, he's like, put the cope on. You know, this is kind of his thing, is the way the guy was. But it's the reminder that there is a dignity to that kind of a thing. Final piece is the humeral veil. So we see this particularly at adoration. But then if we were to be around, there's a sort of offshoot of it. It's called a vimpa, that's used for celebrations with a bishop. So the different elements of the bishop's authority, his crozier and his mitre. Those are honored. I could split a lot of hairs here, but ultimately the humeral veil and the vimpa are for handling holy things, but I'll focus on the humeral veil because it's for handling the holiest of things, our Lord himself. So this is how the Eucharist is handled, but sometimes people are unnecessarily scandalized in that they think, oh my gosh, the priest should never touch the monstrance. That's why he's got the humeral veil, because he could, you know, he's handling something holy. That's not its initial purpose. That's actually the word humeral veil is like the word human, is like the word humor, is like the word humility. It is about the dust of the earth, right? It's the idea that it is your humility. So it is the final thing that really hides you over. So if you've got a good humeral veil, once you got the humeral veil on and you've got the monstrance in front of you, you're not going to be seen as a priest, right? Not even your hands are seen. So it's meant to hide you, to make you humble in a final way. That is the purpose of the humeral veil. It's and yes, it serves for you as the reminder, hey, when you handle that which is holy, do not do so lightly. But you know, it is ultimately meant to that when I'm doing benediction and I've got the humeral veil on, you're not seeing me. You're seeing Jesus. So again, kind of this full circle completion of the vestments are not about the glorifying of the priest. Is it easy for people to get caught up in that? I think so, but I also think sometimes that's overstated. They're ultimately about glorifying Jesus. So, you know, the title that I chose for the talk of right, do the clothes make the man? Well, they do, but not this man. They make the Lord, right? They point to the Lord himself. That's what the vestments are ultimately for. So, kind of want to stop there, leave some time for questions. Deacon, you do not have to stay in your vestments. They're very toasty, I know. I am happy. I'm going to try and look up also what our next Coffee and Catholicism is going to be as I'm answering questions. So, okay, yes.
So why on the deacon's chasuble does it have an H-shaped piping, and why is it a Y-shaped piping on the priest's chasuble?
Sure. So the question, why does the deacon's dalmatic have a like sort of H-shaped piping running through it, and then the priest have sort of a Y-shaped piping running through it? And that's totally stylistic. So there are different schools of liturgical craft that have developed. So different parts of the world have different artistic sensibilities. So just like you can go and say, oh, that's kind of Baroque art, that's Gothic architecture, that like you can do sort of the same thing with vestments. And there are certain ones that have just become more popular or normative. And then eventually they become so common that they're just drawn in without any kind of thought. So the piping is one of those things that's just become so common that most folks probably wouldn't be able to tell you. But a lot of the vestments that are common now, at least that I've seen within the Archdiocese, are more the Gothic style of vestments. Those are, for example, my preference. I actually, full disclosure, I apologize to those of you who prefer the Mass in the Extraordinary form. I prefer the Gothic style of vestments over the Roman style, like which is what Deacon was wearing, and what is more traditional to the Extraordinary form. There's no strict requirement either way, one way or the other. That it literally is a matter of taste in that. But certain ones have become more comfortable with certain liturgical expressions. There's one that Deacon and I both have laughed about. It is the conical style, and conical, so it's like a cone. It is, I think, the goofiest looking style of vest, because it comes to a taper down at your feet. I don't understand the logic or the artistic style of it. It's kind of like some art styles I just look at and go, that's not for me. But somebody clearly thought that was, you know, so there are, just know that there are artistic schools when it has come to the art of making vestments. And so that often is to somebody who matters and know, or like who cares about it, somebody that matters to them, that they'll know what that looks like. So what you're typically seeing with that H shape and that Y shape is just echoing of like Gothic styling of vestments. Yes?
Father, what does the priest ever just wear cassock and surplice? And if so, when?
Sure. So cassock would be considered like, cassock or clerics are considered sort of your standard dress as a priest. And actually, all things being equal, the cassock still probably would have pride of place in terms of like its overall meaning. So that's why, like, when there are maybe more significant liturgical events, or like the bishop's going to be here, or it's confirmation, or it's Easter, or it's Christmas, like I try and wear those things. But the cassock and surplice for a priest, it's if you're sitting in choir, for example, in the liturgy. So we haven't ever had the opportunity really to observe that until Deacon was with us. So as a cleric, Deacon sits in choir when he is going to distribute communion in the extraordinary form of the Mass. But as soon as he steps into a functional role, you put on the stole that is representative of your office. So he puts on the stole for the distribution of communion. So there are very few things where a priest would only be wearing cassock and surplus, because most of the time, if he's wearing surplus, he's also going to be exercising some sort of priestly role. Now, there are moments where you would do that. Maybe, for example, higher liturgies where you have lots of clerics. If you're functioning essentially as a master of ceremonies or an altar server, you might dress that way because you're not exercising anything that is specifically priestly in your ministry. But it would be pretty rare in the ordinary experience of Catholics to just be dressed that way as a priest.
And is that the the cassock and surplice, the traditional garb for altar boys then?
So again, that's one of those things that is, it's developed through the life of the church. So it is only within the last however many decades that girls have been allowed to serve in the Mass. So the ordinary practice was, and this goes back to the fact that the vast majority of the time when you were celebrating the Mass, you had multiple clerics who were assisting in the liturgy. So there are so many layers to this that we tend not to be aware of or think about. So in Mass, you would have clerics that were in various roles all the way through. So like when you would start seminary, you'd be enrolled as a porter, and then you would have these different ministries that were entrusted to you, and generally they would have some sort of situation within the liturgy. So the liturgy itself, even the way it was structured, was not simply a functional reality of getting stuff from A to B, but it was also meant to be reflective of the ordering of the cosmos, essentially. So the servers come to represent the angels that are assisting in the kingdom of heaven, and so they all have their different roles. As those ministries were suppressed or that the church moved away from them, then they took on more of just a functional kind of element. But the preservation, particularly of boys wearing cassock and surplice, is a reminder of the connection of the role of clerics in the liturgy. Is it traditional? Yes, I would say in a small T way that it is a reminder of what the church's liturgical praxis had been. I wouldn't go so far as to say necessarily that one is objectively better than the other, because it's more talking about the reality of the history of the liturgical practice of the church, which is a much bigger conversation. But that's ultimately where the practice of altar servers, boy altar servers wearing cassocks and surplus, comes from. So, but it's two different kind of paradigms that are there, especially after the Second Vatican Council. Since we are only 60 some years out from the council, the church is the church's liturgical praxis is going to redevelop over time, because it developed over 1900 centuries. So 1900 centuries versus handful of decades, who knows how the praxis is going to unfold. And I think it's very important for us to remember where we're standing in the midst of history vis-a-vis where we were at, to kind of get the sense of those things. But it's really kind of understanding where we came from and how those things fit together that unlocks some of the meaning that's there. Yes.
Could you speak a little bit to how everyone would be robed if there was like say someone was being ordained and the archbishop was there and many priests?
Sure, sure. So the actual preference of the church is that you would be, so again, you show dignity by putting stuff on stuff. Ideally, the even in concelebration, when there are lots of priests gathered together, and let's say there are lots of deacons for like a high diocesan liturgy, the ideal would be everybody's in the maximal number of their vestments. So this would mean for deacons that all of them are in dalmatics, and for priests that all of them are in chasubles. What the practice has become, and I would say unfortunately, I mean, this is I think I'm in line with the church here, that unfortunately, most of the time, priests will just wear their stoles, unless they are like a main concelebrant. Some of that is practical, in that you know, the diocese does not have the ability to keep a couple hundred chasubles and dalmatics just laying around the cathedral, for example, for a handful of liturgies through the year. It's harder task than you'd expect to, like, give them to the priests and then expect them to remember them to bring them with them to each of these liturgies. And so then you're left with the option either of having everybody wear a stole that roughly look the same, or wearing a bunch of chasubles that are wildly different, even when they're the same liturgical color. So I'll give you a real life example of this. My own ordination, I was the only priest ordained that year. Portion of my family is, extended family is not Catholic. And so we were at mom and dad's house afterwards, kind of celebrating. And my non-Catholic family members asked me, "So, yeah, what did all of those different colors that the priests were wearing mean?" So if you know the logic of the liturgy, they were all technically wearing white. Technically is doing a lot of work there in that sentence. Because of the different interpretations of what that might mean. That's to say we are in practice sometimes very far away from what Holy Mother Church would desire, the display of unity. So the church would desire high dignity. So everybody wearing the fullness of what their office would expect them to wear, and unity. So that you would also have, there are dioceses that do have diocesan chasubles or diocesan dalmatics. But when that isn't possible, the church almost prefers not to display a lack of unity, that you would have this guy wearing this one and this guy wearing that one, and then where it almost becomes then confusing and contradictory. So then it sort of reverts to a kind of less is more, so as to not become an obstacle and a distraction. But then that would be a simple way of saying, and then there are other things that are indicative of a very high liturgy, but in terms of vesture, it would be deacons in their dalmatics, priests in their chasubles, and the bishop making use of all of the elements of his office as well. So mitre when he's supposed to, his crozier when he's supposed to, all of those different elements. A tunicle. We'll save the tunicle for later. That there are all sorts of, like, you could really go down a rabbit hole with this. I've got a whole book on the, I was telling Deacon, I think it's entitled, like, The Costumes of Clerics. Like, it's a book from the 1800s that I found a reprint of to, like, do some studying and learning way back when. I've got it packed up right now for when we move offices. But it's a book. It's a thick book. Yes.
You said the stole went all the way back to Roman times, where they wore it kind of like a scarf.
Sure. Yep.
And I know the Romans were very high on sashes.
Yes.
But was that like different levels of leadership?
Yes. So yeah, it seems like different offices or different ranks had different either like widths of the stole or different orientations. So just like, you know, the deacons is typically pinned at the right shoulder. Deacons would be pinned at the right shoulder, and prior to 1962, the priest would cross his over his chest, and then the bishop would have his hanging down. So yeah, so we did preserve that even.
The only reason I bring that up, because I know, like in the military, if you've ever seen officers that actually have a sword,
yep.
It's on a sash,
yep.
And that comes from Roman times.
Exactly.
And it's always worn in one direction,
yep.
With a sword on the right hip, unless you're religious.
Yep.
And you don't have a sword, and then you wear it the opposite direction, and they put something else in where the sword would be.
Yeah. So again, and that speaks to the connection of liturgical praxis and the ceremony of like the world. So it's really a very Western thing that Western Christendom was a reality where the influence of the faith and politics, the faith and society were shaped together. And so there are these places. So actually, you can even see a preservation of this if you look back to when Pope Leo was installed or was elevated as Pope. There is a specific, I want to say it's 11 queens or princesses within the nations of Europe who are allowed to wear white in his presence. And it relates to the ordering of the way these societies have historically interacted with the church in its liturgical praxis. So it's very similar to that sense that there are certain things within Western society, Western European society, that we can only understand in their fullness in reference to the life of the church and its liturgy as well. Yes?
This is probably a really silly question, but with how intentional Catholicism is with its symbology and keeping to scripture and tradition and all of those things, scripturally, we know that the priests were only to be clothed in like linen.
Yeah.
You said your vestments are toasty. My assumption is they're polyester.
Yeah.
Linen still exists. Why
yes.
Is there
so,
no conformity there?
There is, the church has allowed for the use of modern materials as time has gone on, either out of a recognition of the, so for example, like why do priests wear black? It's because black was the cheapest thread. That was where that was part of the reason of how that became a standard thing. It was the cheapest thread, so it was the easiest to purchase, and then all sorts of other meaning about, okay, well, black is like you're dead to the life of the world, all of these other theological meanings got attached to it, but ultimately it was because it was the cheapest. So the church has, in a small T tradition kind of way, always allowed for the use of other materials that may be more cost effective to recognize the lack of ability to obtain or create easily, especially in a missionary society, right, or world, that you may not always have linen or it may get damaged or whatever. And so it's more of a recognition of that. But you definitely can tell a difference when you're wearing one or the other in terms of how badly you sweat in things. So there are practical reasons for all of that too. Well worth remembering. So maybe one more question. Yes?
So the gold color, is that liturgical?
Yeah, so there are certain variations. So of course the traditional liturgical colors, right? So you have white, you have red, you have black, you have violet, green, and you have rose. And then there are certain countries in the world, the United States is not one of them, but there are certain countries in the world that do have an indult for wearing blue on Marian feast days. Again, I will reiterate, the United States is not one of them, even if you may occasionally encounter that. Again, I guess it's only a lot of rules if you follow them. But so I say that, don't get bent out of shape if you see other nations of the world where priests are vested in blue. There are nations that have been given indults. For example, the Philippines is actually one of them. But anyway, white is one of those colors that in the practice of things throughout the, again, the small T tradition of the church has become so varied that gold is acceptable. So, right, that's, and it's especially, you'll even then start seeing it in some liturgical documents or commentaries for things like Christmas, Easter, ordinations, pontifical high masses. Again, things with higher dignity becomes a way of framing or accenting the white celebrations. So that's a good catch, that the gold is just one further extension, if you will, of the white.